Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Art History
Welcome to the podcast. My name is Natalie, and it is just me here today, but I am joined by Doug Meyer. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a kind of a sunny day here in New York.
Oh, nice. Glad to hear that. It's been very warm here in California, almost a little too warm.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us, and we'll kind of jump right in with you introducing yourself and telling our listeners a little bit about you.
Okay. I always find it a difficult thing to talk about who I am and what I do because I do so many different things. But so I'm an artist, a designer. I do site-specific installations and a ton of different things. In the past, I was in publishing. I was design and art directors for various media magazines and outlets. And oh my gosh, I've just kind of done so many things, and I still do a lot of these things, and they all kind of get incorporated into my work. But I'm really excited you guys are doing this podcast, because I think the gist of it is to be talking about this new book I have coming out called Heroes a Tribute, which is a project that I worked on for about 2.5 years, which is it started out as an exhibition that traveled from New York to Miami and Los Angeles, and then it was turned into a book. And it is a sort of a celebration and a tribute to some of the 50 first creatives who died of AIDS. And I'm very excited because the book just came out the day before yesterday on the 4th. So it's now, it's now on sale and people can buy it. So,
That's awesome. I didn't realize that it wasn't out yet. So that is very cool. I have a copy right in front of me. It's gorgeous. So listeners, I'll post pictures and they can kind of get an idea of what we're talking about here. And just to give a little background to them on Heroes, it all kind of started out of a fundraiser dinner that you were invited to decorate or host.
Well, it was more than a dinner or whatever. They've been doing this for years. It's DIFA, which is the Design Industry Foundation for Fighting AIDS. And they do these things. They're called Dining by Design, these events. And they do them in various cities throughout the United States, and they're huge fundraisers. And the one in New York is obviously the oldest one, and it's the one that's always continued because some cities, they've done it for a few years and then they go to another city. But they invite different organizations, publications, designers to create spaces. And I was asked, it was in 2014, by a woman named Pam Jacarina, who's the editor-in-chief of Lux Magazine, if I would do their space. And I've known Pam for a long time. She's really great. And she said, you know, would you be able to do this? And I'm like, I kind of got to think about it. Because for me, those kind of events, they really drive me crazy, because it seems they're all driven by cocktails and dinners and all this. And the DIFA events, they're up for about a week and a half. I think it's a week and a half. In New York, it's in conjunction with the Architectural Digest Home Show. So they're at the piers. And so one of the piers is just all the DIFA event, the Dining by Design. And so people come in and they look at the spaces, and they're all, designed and decorated, and kind of, some are really wild and stuff. For me, the last thing I ever wanted to do was to decorate a space and just, you know, like, oh, and you know, everyone kind of look at it and go, oh, that's pretty. And or that's interesting or whatever. So for me, when you're doing an event like this, especially for AIDS, and one of the reasons why AIDS is such a big thing for me is because I've lost so many friends to AIDS. And I always feel that there's a responsibility to somehow remind people. Even though, yeah, it's DIFA, but they're acronyms and people just don't even, oh, it's DIFA. Half the people don't even know what it stands for. So
there is a little bit of like a glazing over that happens in a lot of these, acronyms. Yeah. And it's kind of a language that's used. So I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I like that term glazing over. So I thought, okay, let me start to think of something because to me, it's like throwing it back in your face. It's like, this is why you're here. So I came up with this idea of doing a space that was really more of a, like, you would be walking into a museum or a gallery. And I always love going into a museum and galleries because to me, it's kind of a sacred place in a way. And people become a little more hushed and there's more concentration to really what you're looking at. So the idea was to do this gallery space. I created these vignettes and they were lined in navy velvet and they were beautifully lit. And I didn't know at the time exactly when I started working on this how many I was going to do. I was going to do at least 15 to 20. I ended up doing 19, what I call the heroes. And because it was the design industry, I felt it was really important to make it heavy on architects, fashion designers, as well as interior designers who had some of the early people that had passed away. Because for me, so many people that are young, and when I say young, I mean people that are 35 and under, had no idea who any of these people were. And they were these people that were in their profession and field that kind of paved the way in a lot of ways and were very, what's the word? I'm thinking, oh God, I'm having a brain fart here. These were really kind of pioneers in their fields and they kind of laid the groundwork for what these people do now. And I really just felt it was important, especially I love that you all are the history babes, because to me, history is very, very important, especially in art. And you kind of need to know art or design or architecture, whatever. You have to have the foundations of knowing the history of something. And it was really interesting. There was, you know, like I was saying, cocktail parties and dinners. So they do these various cocktail parties and a big dinner at these events. And the night of the big dinner, where you have all the whoozy wetsits and everything there. It was really interesting. I was walking around and I came back into the space and it was kind of amazing. Like every single person who was a big whoozy what's it that was actually at the event, and there were hundreds of people at this thing, were in the space. And they were all just kind of like really quiet and just looking at the heroes sculptures and reading, because each exhibition accompanied the actual obituaries, whether they were from the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times of each hero. And then there was a little more didactic information, and then there was a wall panel that just kind of explained what this was about. And there were people in there crying and people coming up to me and saying, oh my God, thank you for doing this. And it was very powerful. And I was like, wow. I mean, it was what I wanted to happen, but I didn't, you know, just because you want something to happen doesn't mean it's going to happen. So, and even that evening, I was approached by several people that said, you know, we should take this somewhere else now. And I was like, okay. And then I sat on it for a few weeks. And at one point during that time period, I'd flown down to Miami was doing some project. I can't remember what it was. An old friend of mine, we had drinks and we said we were just going to have one glass of wine because we hadn't eaten or anything. And she has a gallery space down there. Her name is Niecy Behrman. So we just started having one glass of wine, and that God knows that literally, I think we had two bottles of wine and we had no food. And during that drinking, she said, you know, why don't you expand this and make a lot more heroes? And then she goes, I'll show it here in Miami. And I started thinking, and then I'm like, okay. So then I can't remember if I emailed or text. And then I sent an whichever email or text to Liz O'Brien, who has a space in New York, who's this amazing dealer. And then one to another dealer I know in Los Angeles, Patrick Dragonette. And they both said yes, like right away. So it was just kind of like, God, I'm drunk and I've committed myself to doing this. So I was just like, okay, that's great. So I really was committed at this point now. And for me, I think a lot of people are this way too. Number one, I work best at the last minute and under pressure, and also mm-hmm. when I have a kind of a goal or an assignment to do. So that meant that I really now had to figure out who else I was going to choose. And it took me months to really just come up with a list, because you're doing so much research, and there's so, unfortunately, there are so many people that I could do.
Yeah. I was going to ask about that, because you ended up narrowing the total list to 48. Or is it 49? 48.
Well, it's 48, and then there was a special limited edition Jack Smith, who was kind of the grandfather of performance art. And so it was kind of a crazy thing to undertake, in a way of just really deciding who to choose. And I just made list and list. And I also, in the back of the book, there's a section called The Notebook. Mm-hmm. Which has photographic images of spreads from this notebook that I had. And I would carry this notebook with me once I started doing this, and I would just do drawings and insert photographs or whatever, or memorabilia from various people that I was thinking of doing. And then I'd start doing these kind of wild little portraits of them. And it really helped me to figure out who I was going to do and how I was going to portray them. Because another thing that I wanted to do when I did this, and when I started with the first 19, is when people saw the heroes, I didn't want it to be all stylistically like it came from one artist's hand. I wanted mm-hmm. people to look at this and not think about, you know, the way that they were created, in a way. I just wanted them to look at each individual piece and then actually think about and understand or learn about who this person was. And a lot of the elements that are used in creating these heroes or these portraits were reflective of, in some way, sometimes, of who they were and what they did. Mm-hmm. As well as the titles of each piece too. So there's, you know, there's a lot of elements going on. And I also had a soundtrack that was on repeat. In full length, it was like almost 2.5 hours. I had a friend of mine who's a DJ, and I gave him a list of who I was doing and what I wanted, songs or interviews or whatever I wanted from certain people. But then he just kind of went with it, and he did a phenomenal job. I mean, he just did amazing, amazing research, and I was absolutely thrilled with the outcome. So it was like, for me, it was also, that creates more this whole installation thing, where it's this, mm-hmm. you know, it's dealing with a lot of, you know, senses and things when you're looking at this, and becomes also subliminal in a way too, when you're going into space and you hear either an interview or songs from that period. And then there's obviously in the exhibition with the obituaries, there was also the playlist as well, and explaining, you know, which song and who did it, and a little history about that also.
Yeah, so you just talked about a lot of things that I want to get to.
I know,
so
I'm sorry.
No, perfect. I'm so glad. I just want to like go through and like individually talk about all those things, because there are a lot of things that I definitely wanted to go into more detail about, like the notebook, because I really liked that you included that. I took art classes throughout high school and into college, and having a sketchbook and having a sketchbook that acted as a notebook too, and was kind of like a diary of sorts, and would come right with me everywhere and just be a receptacle for whatever, was so important, and it was a skill I'm really glad that I learned. So I wanted you to talk about that and including that, and how that helped your process, because you're obviously biting off a lot here, even just choosing how to represent these individuals all stylistically differently, because you did, and it's a cohesive body of work. It really is. They look really well together, but they are all very unique and stylistically diverse. So I'm imagining the notebook had a huge hand in that. And I just wanted you to maybe talk about that a little more for some of our artist listeners. We have a lot of young artists who kind of like to get ideas and advice on things like that.
Well, I've always, ever since I went to Parsons School of Design, when it was mm-hmm. I think referred to as Parsons School of Design, I don't know how it's referred to now. I know it's, you know, it's part of the new school and everything. But ever since, I think almost from day one, I had a notebook. I have various sizes of notebooks. Some are really small that I can just throw in my backpack. And some, depending on, like the Heroes notebook was kind of big. It was like 10 by 15. And it's, I would think maybe a lot of your listeners too are probably the same way. I think when you're an artist or whatever, you have so much crap going on in your head, and you have mm-hmm. so many ideas. You sometimes think, okay, that's an idea, and you'll remember it. But if you don't write it down or just do a little sketch of it or whatever it may be, you're going to forget about it. And it might have been like a really amazing idea. And right. it's kind of an interesting way for me. It's kind of like what Instagram is, because there's so many amazing things on Instagram. So many weird things, but so many amazing things. And I literally just save so much stuff, because it, at least when I'm doing that, I don't have to write something down. I can go back and reference it again. But to me, so much of what a notebook is, it's several things. It's a great kind of archive and reference piece that you have of your work and thoughts. And the other thing too is it really helps you when you actually either write or draw or paint or whatever in your notebook, what you're working on. And it helps you work through and makes you, at least for me, and especially for this project, when I'm working on a drawing or a sketch or something of somebody, say it was, you know, Halston or Sam Wagstaff or Lee Bowery or whatever, you really start thinking about that person and that individual. And it helps me get in sort of a mindset of who these people were. Mm-hmm. So when I would be doing more research, even though like I knew Lee Bowery was actually the very first one I did. And I always knew that I wanted to do a portrait or a sculpture of him. And I mean, he was easy, but really hard, because there were so many ways to portray him, because he was just an absolute genius at creating these kind of looks for himself, and not just his face, his entire body. He was really easy. Some were like incredibly difficult, because I just, you know, I would work on something and it just was awful. And I would just, and you know, when something's really bad and you keep working on it, it just gets worse and worse.
So and frustrating.
Yes. And you get more and more frustrated. So it's just like, oh God. So then you like, okay, you kind of trash that. And then you start thinking about it again and you work on other things, and then you go back to it and you start another thing. And then one of the most difficult ones I had doing was Alvin Ailey. And I had literally done three, and every single one of them I hated. I mean, they were just, you know, one was worse than the next, and I just kind of mangled them up, and one I threw across the room and broke some glass on a picture, and because I was just really like, oh my God. And then when I did that, I think it was 3 or 4 days before the opening of the New York show at Liz O'Brien. And I was like, oh my God. Cause I felt that Alvin Ailey was a really important figure to be in the group. And it's one of those things too. I think I mentioned earlier is like, you know, I work better under pressure sometimes and under a deadline. So that evening I went to bed, and then you know how stuff just comes to you.
Yeah.
It just kind of came to me, and I'm like, okay. So I've always had like collections of weird things. So I had all these building blocks and in a box, and I started thinking of them and started thinking about Alvin Ailey's dance. And for me, that kind of modern dance can be very architectural and structural and all about balance and things. So I thought, okay, so the way I was going to portray him then was to take these building blocks and create these weird kind of little sculptures that were about balance. And so I set them up on seamless color paper, various colors, and then I used my iPhone and I photographed them before they kind of like tipped over. And then I take them into Photoshop, and then I'm all about kind of color and odd combinations and weird mixtures, but something that is in the end quite beautiful, hopefully. And I always love the colors of 60s faded magazines. So I wanted the colors in this to be a bit faded, that it was kind of from another moment in time in a way, but yet they're very, very abstract and very modern, the imagery. So I then took those, printed them on really heavy paper, and then attached them with this wild sort of material I use in all my work. It's this silver insulation tape that's really strong, and it looks just like silver leaf. And so I attached them all together in the back, and it just folded up, but it made this kind of accordion that you could stand up. And the colors were quite beautiful, but it just had this rhythm and movement that to me really said Alvin Ailey. And I was like, oh my God. So literally I finished the damn thing like 7 hours before the show opened. So,
I'm looking at it right now. No, this is a great example. And like, I like how through all the frustration and the three prior attempts, it seems like the process of the final result ended up a lot more fun in the making too. Like even you saying you use your iPhone, and like, it reads to me almost like a zine. And I'm looking at a photograph of it, so it might be a little different in person, but I mean,
no, it actually does. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it's really cool, and it's light and it's fun, and it does kind of evoke this like movement and balance. I like that story of that one a lot too.
Oh, well, good. Well, so, okay, so now I can tell you another story too. So then when I was working on this first group, I wanted to do the fashion designer Patrick Kelly, who was from Mississippi, mm-hmm. and he moved to Paris and he became this huge, huge, huge rage in Paris. This big American fashion designer. He was African American and he was a star over there. And he was well known here, but much more so in Europe. And I think one of the big breaks for him in the US was one time on the David Letterman show, Betty Davis was a guest and she was really old at this time. And she was wearing head to toe Patrick Kelly. And it was just kind of, and you can Google it actually. It's mm-hmm. all over YouTube. And it's fascinating to see Betty Davis and then she talks about Patrick Kelly, but then to see this dress and how kind of, you know, once again, it was something that hadn't been seen before really in this time period fashion where it was just this simple, tightish black dress with these huge, huge buttons that just went down the front that were primary color.
Oh, yeah.
And this big hat that had buttons on it and stuff. And one of his signatures was buttons. And so I had this, like I said, I always had these weird collections of crap. So I had this collection of all these buttons and I figured, oh, somehow I needed to portray Patrick Kelly with these buttons. And it was probably twofold. One, I couldn't figure out what to do for the first group for the Diffa show. And then two, I just didn't have the time because what I ended up finally doing, and it was one of those things that finally came to me. I was watching some, maybe it was on 60 Minutes, you know, some old clip of an interview with Patrick Kelly. And so he started talking about, and I started doing more and more reading again on him. And he started talking about how he has this enormous collection of black memorabilia. And how he loved Gollywogs and Jemima collectibles and everything. So I was like,
kind of these subversive characters,
right? But it was stuff.
But
that
it was like a reclaiming,
loved.
Yeah.
And he collected it, and he also incorporated it into his designs and his collection. Mm-hmm. Like his actual label was a Gollywog, and he would then do drawings and imprint those on fabric. And at one time before. He was in an interview one time and people said, you know, ask him how the NAACP felt about it. And he goes, I don't know. And he goes, actually, I really don't care. He goes, this makes me happy. So, and to me, when I was creating these portraits, it was all about how would that individual see this portrait? Would they mm-hmm. like it? Would it be meaningful to them in some way? Would it, in their eyes, portray them? So the idea then was to take all these buttons and then make this gollywog out of buttons. And that was my representation of Patrick Kelly. And it took forever to do. I think there was over like 760 buttons that I used in this piece. And in the book, there's a double page spread at the back mm-hmm. side of it, which I think is quite beautiful. And then there's obviously a picture of the front, but it was one of those things that I felt it was really important in the exhibitions that in the introduction, I had a lot of text in this introduction that I really talked about why I did and portrayed Patrick Kelly this way, because I didn't want anyone to be offended and thinking, oh God, you know, it's politically incorrect and blah, blah, blah. But to my shock, you know, no one in any place was offended by it, thankfully, or thought it was, you know, just too off the cuff. And I recently, someone was interviewing me like last week or something and ask about this. And I said, you know, I was shocked by it, but then he said, but why do you think that was? And I think one of the things was when people would come and they would see the show, it's kind of overwhelming when you see the number of people. And this is just such a small, tiny number and who these people were and what they contributed and how young some of them were when they died and what they really could have done. And it was literally, it annihilated an entire generation. And so I think when people were seeing these things, they're not thinking, oh, they really are understanding the moment that they're seeing this. And it does become very hushed and they start thinking about it, I think. So
that's interesting. It almost like puts into perspective and combats kind of the inclination people have right now to jump on anything as offensive. Which, you know, there are plenty of very offensive things out there, so I'm not trying to say that. But, you know, you having to worry about this is kind of an example of people wanting to get upset about things, wanting to get angry. And I'm not surprised that the breadth of this show put that into perspective. And I wanted to talk about something else you said, because it reminded me of a phrase you used, a lost generation, kind of borrowing the language, I think, from like World War One and Two. And this idea, which is something that really interests me. I've done a lot of work in like post-World War II art and an idea of like transferable trauma and what something like a loss of a generation can do to a community and to a group of people. So I know that this is something that you lived through and experienced and watched and is very deeply personal. So I just wanted you to talk maybe a little bit more about why you chose that phrase and what it means to you.
So that phrase was kind of the title of the little essay that I wrote in the beginning of the book. And as I said, it really was a lost generation. So this was an homage to all of these people. And, you know, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and I knew that it was literally the day after high school I moved to New York. And Louisville was a very interesting and had a lot of culture. I mean, there was a great museum, the Speed Museum. They had the Actors Theater of Louisville where they had the Festival of American Plays. There's just a lot of cool things in Louisville. So it's not like, oh yeah, you grew up in Kentucky and then you decided to move to New York. No, Louisville was very interesting, but as a little gay kid growing up there, I was fine until we moved again. And then I went to high school and I didn't know anybody and I was just treated like crap. So I could not wait. I mean, literally my whole high school years were just a complete blur. And it's something I would never want to relive or go through again. So, and then when I came to New York, between my junior and senior year, I went to Parsons Summer School. And my brother also went to Parsons before me because there's, you know, 7 years difference between us. And so I always knew that I was going to move to New York and my parents would take us up to New York. My dad had business up here. And so I always loved New York. And it was just, to me, it was just like where I needed to end up. And so the day that I moved here, it was like I'd always lived here. And so I moved to New York in the summer of 1977, which that dates me. And when I started coming up here, I was at Studio 54 every night. I was at Mud Club. Cause I was this cute little thing and I think it was funny. And
I'm going to include in our post the picture of you at the very beginning, that Polaroid, cause you were adorable.
Oh, thank you. And I had like kind of long hair and no one had long hair then. And I would just kind of like, you know, flip it around but New York. At the time when I moved here, it was just such a cool place. It's completely different than how it is now because there are so many parts of the city now that have just become so developed and so kind of expensive and, you know, hip, cool new areas. But at that time, I mean, like literally everything on the West Side, it was prostitution central. It was like the meatpacking district was literally meatpacking. You really never went down there. I mean, there were sex clubs there and prostitutes at night, and then, you know, during the day it was just really gross because literally the cobblestone streets were just covered in like meat fat and it was just really kind of gross. And the city was very, very grungy. I mean, it wasn't clean like it is now and there wasn't a lot of development, but I kind of love that. I love things that aren't perfect or pristine. So, I mean, living in New York at that time, it was amazing. And it was also the interesting thing too, at that time, especially in New York, and I'm sure it was the same in San Francisco, it wasn't about people being gay or anything. I mean, everyone just kind of mixed with one another and everyone had a great time and got along and it was all good. And that lasted for quite a while. And then in 1981 was the first time that there was that article in the New York Times talking about this rare disease that is hitting the gay community. And people, you know, were really freaked out. And as time went on, it became apparent that this was a very, very, you know, kind of deadly disease and people had no idea. It was not named AIDS at that point. And then early on, it was named GRID, which was a gay-related immune deficiency. And when people got it, it truly was a death sentence. Some people would be diagnosed and then 3 weeks later, they would be dead. And then there would be other people that would, through various cocktail medicine mixtures, could survive for a period of time. And the sad thing is you could always, not always, but you could kind of tell if someone was sick. And then, of course, at that point, then there was the Kaposi's, which were these, you know, Kaposi's when they started becoming visible, like on your neck or your face or your hands. And people viewed this as like the plague and they would not. I mean, so the point is I'm trying to make is once this happened, all this where everyone got along and we're hanging out together and no one cared about anything, then everything became segregated. And I mean, gay people just kind of stayed to themselves and straight people stayed away from gay people because no one knew how this was transmitted, really. A lot of people
were just scared
and they were just completely freaked out. So it really, really did change. I think a lot of the strides and everything the gay community made as far as, you know, fitting in and everything. And then it just kind of completely, just separated things again. And in the early stages before there was any possible way of managing the disease. I mean, people were just dying. I went to, in the first 2.5 years, I went to over 70 funerals. So that meant that everyone that I knew from when I was young that was gay and when I was in college and people then that I just knew as friends would hang out and whatever. It was just like, it was absolutely horrible. And the interesting thing, and this is something just weird. My husband and I, we started watching, although it's been on for a few months now, or been out, this new series called Pose on, I don't know if it's on HBO or Showtime or FX or whatever, but it's this amazing series with Billy Porter and the rest of the cast. I don't really know their name. And Sandra Bernhardt just came in the last two episodes of the first season. And it's totally of this time period where, you know, you have those voguing houses up in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And it talks about their families that created these houses. And it was during the beginning of AIDS. And then they just, like last night, I think when I was watching one of the episodes, I just started freaking out because they were in this AIDS ward. And I just remember visiting people that I knew. And it was just the most horrific thing. And that's another thing too, that another reason why I wanted to do this is because I wanted people that would see this then to maybe do a little more research on that time period on the disease, because now it's a completely manageable disease pretty much. And back then, if you had it, you were just shunned. And the interesting thing about it is with the obituaries that are in the book and that were in the exhibitions, there were so many that when you start reading them that you realize that they did not, and you go into the history and you read about that. Like say, for example, Alvin Ailey, you know, incredibly successful artist. You know, he founded the Alvin Ailey Dance Company and it's still around today. And everyone in that time period was very stigmatized, meaning families. Yeah. It's like, oh my God, you know, my son or whatever, my God, they had AIDS. Ooh, I don't know how to deal with that. And either family would omit it or even the person who passed away would be their request to say, mm-hmm. You know, I passed away from cancer, or in Alvin Ailey's case, it was, I can't remember what the name of it is, but he asked his doctor to say that it was this strange kind of rare blood disease. Mm-hmm. So his mother and his brother would not be embarrassed by that. And that happened time and time again, like Robert Reed, you know, Mr. Brady from the Brady Bunch. Yeah. His original obituary did not mention anything about that, of how he died, but then about 2 weeks later there, and I can't remember who decided to do that, but then they did a reprint and said that, you know, he had died of AIDS. And it's literally, you know, if you get the book and each of the sculptures are accompanied by, what we had done was we had compiled various news sources and obituaries into what we call the obituary. So it gives a clear picture of who these people were and what they contributed during their time period. And I know I'm just rambling on.
No, but it's great.
The interesting thing too about the obituaries when I started researching them is that the New York Times always did a better job, I realized, than the LA Times. But during this time period when people were dying so quickly, and a lot of these people were famous, but famous in communities like, you know, the gay community or some strange music world or something, but was small and they were maybe underground or avant-garde. And this is before the internet. And it was very, very difficult. You couldn't go out and Google somebody. You had to make phone calls and you had to track people down. And even making phone calls back then was, you know, very, very difficult. People didn't have cell phones. Mm-hmm. So they kind of had to be, you know, near a phone if you're going to call. And then, you know, a lot of people didn't have voice message machines. So it was a very difficult time for people that were even writing these obituaries. And in New York, like if it was a fashion obituary, it was written by Carrie Donovan, who was one of the fashion writers at the New York Times. And if they were in the design world, interiors or architecture, it was oh my God, I'm having another brain fart here. What was her name? It'll come to me. And these were people that, you know, that they knew all these people and these were their friends. Then they had to write about their death and they were doing this on a constant basis. And there were a lot of these heroes, not a lot, but there were a few of the heroes that, and that's why we did a compilation for the book here. And they weren't just a direct pull from the New York Times or the LA Times or wherever. It was because some of them didn't have obituaries. Like Klaus Nomi, who was, he was just an absolutely brilliant performer who no one had ever seen anything like him before. And he'd been doing this forever, but he was just kind of on the cusp of becoming really well known. And he was on the CBS morning news show one day and he would do these bizarre operas and he'd kind of dress like this Terry Mugler alien. And he was just a fascinating guy. He was from Germany. And when he got sick, everyone that knew him, either they were sick or they had died, or he just isolated himself and he died by himself alone. Mm. He was basically penniless and there was no obituary for him. And it's fascinating when you think about it, because current generations now are so influenced by what he did as performance and how he created his look and what he just did as a body of work. So someone who is now so influential, back then, they were just disregarded as anything. And then you have another story that's kind of similar to that, is the model Gia, who was considered, I guess, one of the first supermodels. And anyone out there that's maybe seen, and this was, God knows, this was a long time ago too, Angelina Jolie portrayed her in her life story. And it was kind of like an ABC movie of the week, but it wasn't. It was like the theaters and stuff. But no, it was actually a very good movie. But how she contracted AIDS was she was a drug addict, and it was through IV, through needles. Mm-hmm. And because she would go in and out of rehab. And then she made her final kind of comeback in a way, and Francesca Scavullo shot her for Cosmopolitan. But the interesting thing is, if somebody Googles this for Gia and they look at the last Cosmopolitan cover, and Cosmopolitan at the time, you know, magazines just are unfortunately a dying breed. Here we go flipping around. But I just read this morning that Traditional Home, which is not a magazine I read, but you know, it was been around forever. They're just ceased their normal publication as of today, I think.
Wow.
Anyway, that's getting off the subject. But if you Google Gia's last cover for Cosmo, she has this big, fluffy, long kind of gown on. Her arms and hands are down by her side. But what the dress does is cover the track marks on her arm because, you know, it's a strapless thing. And right after that, she relapsed again. And then she was from Philadelphia or outside of Philadelphia, and her parents took her in again, and they were completely embarrassed by this whole thing. And then, you know, they discovered that she was sick. And I mean, she was literally, you know, one of the biggest models in New York and around the world at the time. And then she just kind of slipped away, went back home. Her last few months, she was a bagger in a grocery store. And it was just wow. Very, very sad. And then when she passed away, her parents were so embarrassed by all this. It was, you know, she was just buried, and I believe there was some small service, but no one in New York even knew that she had died because there was no obituary or anything. So it's stories like that that just kind of, you know, go on and on.
Yeah, there just seemed to be like so much stigma. And do you feel like there still kind of is? I mean, this catalog, this show obviously is doing a lot to break the stigma by just, again, talking about it, showing people that, like, I didn't know died of AIDS. I'm sure a lot of people who would look through the catalog would have similar reactions to some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, knew they were artists, knew they were practicing, just didn't know their association to AIDS. And I think it's really important that we talk a lot about on the podcast, you know, history is just made up of who we talk about. So if we're not talking about someone, they kind of get erased just by consequence. Mm-hmm. So this catalog really is doing a lot to bring people back into the mainstream who maybe slipped out of it because of all this stigma. And what has that been like, and how important is that to you? I can tell that it obviously is.
That was literally one of the driving forces that made me want to do this, because if I hadn't come up with this idea, I would never have done anything for the DIFA event, mm-hmm. you know, back in 2015 or whatever. I've done other projects about AIDS for AIDS awareness. Cause I just feel that it's just, somebody's got to do it. And there are a lot of people that do, but I just think it's very important to just bring back the dialogue of this to people and make them remember, or if they weren't alive during that time period, try to make them understand in some way. It was like being in a war. You can't really describe or explain how horrific it is to see, you know, people that you've known your whole life. And at the time, you know, I was in my 20s, but still my whole life, these people that, you know, at least half of my life, a lot of them I knew, that they're gone. And they're gone in such a, you know, such a horribly sad way. And I'll probably be killed for saying this, but it's kind of like, I can only sort of try to relate it when Trump became president for me. And every single day, it's like one crazy event after another. And is it ever going to end?
It's almost surreal.
And yeah, it's completely surreal. And that's kind of like in the last 30 years or whatever, that's the one thing that I could say is kind of loosely like this, because you're just, I wake up every day and I turn on CNN and I'm just in shock.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like,
you can't imagine what's
going
to happen next. There's just no.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And every, you know, they need to change that breaking news to something else, because after every commercial, breaking news. And you're just like, okay. So in a strange way, that's kind of like what it was during this AIDS war in the beginning, because it was always breaking news. Oh my God. Someone, you know, so-and-so has just been diagnosed. So-and-so just died. So-and-so is back in the hospital. And it's just something that you can't wrap your mind around. Because, you know, none of us grew up during, or in the United States, we've never had a war here.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like what it was like, at least in my view. So once again, I'm rambling.
No, I have no idea.
What your question was.
I don't either, but I'm sure we danced around it enough, but.
I'm very excited about this book because I think it came out so beautiful. I mean, just the design and the layout and
I completely agree.
To me, it's a celebration. So therefore, we shot most all of the heroes on colored grounds. So as you're flipping through it, it's just so lively with color and these images. And then I tried to get as many actual photographs of the actual heroes in the book. I would have loved to have had more, but damn, you know, when you have to buy the usage rights of this stuff, it's crazy expensive. So I think there's maybe like 18 or 19 that are actual, you know, Freddie Mercury to Robert Reed, Rock Hudson, Tina Chow, Keith Haring, Nuria,
Grace photo,
Liberace.
Great photo of Klaus Nomi that I'm looking at.
Oh,
once
yeah,
in the
it's
book
also in the back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, and the other thing too that I felt that was really important with the book is, and the publisher, Traw Publishing, which is an art publishing house, and they're based in Miami, they did a fantastic job with this. And one of my big things was it needs to be affordable. Cause you know, I hate when you see a book, oh, it's 65, 75 or whatever. So the book is 45, which I think is incredibly accessible to a lot of people.
I agree. I was actually going to comment on that. So I'm glad you said it. Because it's a beautiful book. I mean, it's an art object in itself. It's like a lovely table book, but it's also so much more because, I mean, you can tell you've really done your research. It's an educational resource for people. It's obviously a memorial. It's deeply personal in a lot of ways, and especially to certain people, I'm sure it's a lot more personal. But it's also kind of an instruction manual in a way, the way you've included how you came up with the idea from start to finish and how it all came together, the playlist, the notebook. Like, it's really comprehensive so far as like what you did with Heroes. So for $45.
It's a bargain.
Yeah, it's a bargain. For sure.
But yeah, I mean, and the great thing too is, you know, it's available on Amazon and through the publisher Trial Publishing, and it's being distributed worldwide by Simon & Schuster. And so I'm just thrilled that it's going to have such a reach now that hopefully people might, you know, like be interested and learn something and understand something a little bit more in a different way and just start maybe educating themselves on the history of this moment, because it was a very dark time in the world's history, I think, when this happened. I mean, just because so many strange things were going on. I mean, at the time when AIDS hit, the Reagans were in office and Ronald Reagan refused to even utter the word AIDS. And that, it really, really just freaked everyone out in the gay community. And it's like, okay, we're on our own and there's no help. And I keep going back I'm going back again to that new series called Pose because it's so well done, but it really does portray that time period and on certain levels and show what was really going on and how frightening and fearful people were. And what you see like on, in a show like that, it was 100 times worse.
Yeah, because they have to lighten it up for TV.
Right. That's for entertainment. But, you know, the reality is something completely different. And just like politically, I've been working on this other project that I call Angels and Villains. And it's really kind of a cast of characters of the good guys and the bad guys during the beginning of AIDS. And it's these wild kind of illustration drawings I'm doing and putting them in this bizarre kind of still life. And it's this huge piece, but doing some more of the research. One of the things that I just found fascinating was in 1984, and AIDS started coming into, even before it was called AIDS, into the mainstream, like beginning of 1981. And at the beginning of 1984, New York City was literally the epicenter where most of the infection was. And then you had San Francisco, which was probably second. And at that time, the mayor of New York was Mayor Ed Koch. And Mayor Ed Koch was literally, you know, he was gay, but he was a complete closet case. And it's always one of those interesting things when someone is a closeted person of whatever, you know, if they're gay or whatever, how they treat or react to something. And during that time period, tens of thousands of New Yorkers were already infected with HIV. And I think it was like 860 something had died at that point, had already died. And this was in New York. And the city of New York at that time to respond to AIDS by 1984 had spent $24,500 in response to it. And that same year in San Francisco, which had 1/10 of the population of New York, that city had spent $4.3 million.
Wow.
And a couple of years after that, it grew to $10 million annually a year. And there's an amazing documentary called How to Survive a Plague by David Francis that this information, a lot of other information that really kind of tells the story of this plague. And it's something that I just highly recommend if someone is even interested in any of this. It's another, like Pose is a really interesting thing to see. This is another really great thing to watch as well.
Perfect. I will include those in the notes for this episode. Yeah, that's horrifying. Repression and stigma are like just as deadly as disease.
Exactly.
It's so frightening.
Yeah, it is frightening. I know.
Oof.
I know. And then also, I mean, I don't know when this is going to air, but you know, I'm going to be in San Francisco. So anyone that's in San Francisco between the 24th and the 29th, I'm doing a lot of talks and actual book signings. I'll be at, like the San Francisco Public Library, the Oakland Museum of Art, the Canopy Space, the Book Passage at Ferry Plaza. I'm doing a thing at Airbnb and the Battery Club, and there's a couple of other things. But
nice. Well,
no, I'm actually excited to be out there during Pride and stuff.
Yeah, you'll have a lot of fun. I'll get this episode out before then, definitely, because I want people to be able to contact you and see you if they are around. Our listeners are very involved.
And also,
they like to talk. They like to engage. They're very fun.
Oh, that's cool. Well, then also in July 13th, I'm doing a big signing at the Museum of Modern Art at the design store there. So I'll be there as well on the 13th.
Nice.
But yeah.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about or address before?
I'm sure there is. I can probably go on for days. But no, I think we hit, you know, all the kind of highlights and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was nice.
This was very nice. Thank you for doing this. It was really great talking to you. I really enjoyed reading Heroes and I especially enjoyed talking to you about it. I think it's a really, really important thing you're doing here. And I've already flagged a few artists that I want us to do full episodes on that I wasn't aware of. And so hopefully we can honor you and your project here by going a little bit extra in depth into some of these people.
Well, fabulous. That's very cool. Well, thank you.
Thank you so
much. Thanks very much. It was a pleasure talking to you. Really enjoyed it.
You too. And you have a great rest of your day.
You too. All right. Thanks, Natalie.
Bye, Doug.
Bye-bye.
All right, guys, thanks for listening. Go check out our social media. Our Instagram is Art History Babes Podcast. Our Twitter is at Art History Babes. Email is arthistorybabes@gmail.com. Go check out our friends at Art and Object. It's a website where you can get a ton of awesome arts resources, including podcasts like this one.
So go visit them at artandobject.com. And go check out our YouTube. Corey's posting all sorts of creative habits videos. We have vlogs. We have episodes. There's a lot of great stuff on there. And as always, you can become a patron if you so choose. Visit our Patreon, patreon.com/arthistorybabes, and become a patron for as low as $1 a month and get that extra content. All right, guys. Thank you so much. We appreciate you. Bye.
The Art History Babes.
You know, I told you before we got on the air here that I just kind of ramble, so I don't even remember what.
No, you're good.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.